Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Total Soccer Show. My name is Joe Lowry, and on this episode, we're talking all about Decision Day, the last day of Major League Soccer's regular season that took place on Sunday. All but one of MLS's 27 teams took the field on Sunday, with several playoff spots up for grabs and some seeding still left to be done. And predictably, there were some wild moments and some wild games as well. Joining me today to look back at some of the craziness and to look ahead to the postseason is a man who I bet has watched more MLS games this season than anyone else. It's MLSsoccer.com's Matt Doyle. Doyle, thanks so much for coming on the show. How you doing?
I'm doing all right, my friend. I imagine that every year in this entire world, I finish on the podium somewhere in terms of most total MLS games watched.
Yes.
I would guess Rick Laws finishes number one, the great Rick Laws, who has been in the league since day one and is the master of the history books. I'm assuming he gets the gold every year, but like I'm sure I've been racking up silver medals for basically the entirety of my adult life.
Which is incredibly impressive. It blows my mind. I'd like to think that I've watched a lot of Major League Soccer, and then I read your column on Monday mornings, and I realize just how much I miss. There's just not enough hours in the day, man, and I genuinely don't know how you do it. I don't know, how comfortable are you with revealing how the sausage is made? Like, how much do you think you actually watch on a week or you know, twice a week basis? Like, how many minutes are you spending watching Major League Soccer or writing about it and pumping out, you know, 4,000 words or whatever it is?
It's more than a 40-hour work week. I would say that so there's 13 games a weekend. I would say I watch 7 or 8 of them completely every single weekend. And then the rest, the other 5 or 6, I'll watch on the website. They do 15-minute game highlight reels, so I'll watch that, and then I'll look at the Second Spectrum stuff and the Opta stuff, and then for obviously it's tougher with the midweek stuff. We had some Wednesdays this week that had 13 games on a Wednesday. Like I, you could get maybe 4 of those in total, and then for the rest, you're definitely leaning more on the recaps. But I would say, so in general, probably ended up watching somewhere around 60% of the entire MLS schedule.
Man,
yeah, full 90-minute chunks, and the rest of them were recaps. And then there were a couple of games that ended up like just brutal scoreless draws that I didn't like. I clicked on the scoreboard, I looked at the lineups, I didn't watch a single thing from maybe a half dozen of those games.
Oh my word. Okay, I got one more follow-up question before we get into the real meat here. How do your eyes stay in your head? I just get tired of looking at a screen after a while. And I think in this day and age, we're all on our phones or on our computers too much. But when your job is to watch 60%+ of every minute of every MLS game, how, like, do you have eye drops? Do you just take frequent naps? What is the protocol here, man?
I get up and I stretch a lot. That's a big one. Like having done this for a good long while now, I have a pretty finely tuned understanding of when headaches are coming on.
Yep.
And you know, so dealing with that usually means hydration or a little snack or you know, 3 minutes of stretching, something like that. And then the greatest motivating factor and the greatest way to sort of remember to keep your eyes open and to keep doing the job is knowing that there are young, hungry kids like Joe Lowry coming up and you know, ready to steal my job. So I got to stay on my toes. Otherwise, you know, I'll be out on the street.
That's right, Doyle. Keep it together, man. You got to work for it. Okay, I want to set the foundation for us here, decision day-wise, to really give us a basis for this conversation. So I'm going to lay out what was happening before decision day. Again, last day of the MLS regular season, some real playoff implications in both conferences. So in the East, there were 4 spots that had already been clinched. New England had already won the Shield, set the record for points in a regular season. A phenomenal year from them. Philly, second, Nashville, and NYCFC. All 4 of those teams had clinched. There were then 3 spots up for grabs between Atlanta, Orlando, the New York Red Bulls, Montreal, DC United, and the Columbus Crew. Out west, Matt, 4 spots were clinched, the same as the Eastern Conference, Seattle, Kansas City, Colorado, and Portland. three spots then up for grabs. Seven teams make the playoffs from each conference here. And those spots were up for grabs between Minnesota, Vancouver, the Galaxy, RSL, and LAFC. And in addition to all of that, in the Western Conference, the top spot was still open between Seattle, Kansas City, and Colorado. As we found out, the Colorado Rapids secured that one seed in the West, which is a phenomenal accomplishment that we'll talk more about later on. Minnesota snagged the fifth seed, Vancouver in sixth, and RSL snuck in and snagged the seventh seed in their last dying breath. In the East, Atlanta secured the fifth seed, Orlando in sixth, and the New York Red Bulls snagged the seventh seed, and managed to drag just about everybody over at MLSsoccer.com in the process. Doyle, having laid that foundation, do you have a top moment from Sunday? Either a moment that made you go, holy crap, I can't believe that just happened, or a moment that you think will be remembered years from now for any number of different reasons?
I think it's two, right? And I would question the sanity of anyone who picks anything other than these two moments. The Demir Krylak goal, off the Justin Miram bicycle kick attempt that ended up being a perfect assist for Krylak to side foot home in the 93rd minute at Sporting Kansas City to lift RSL over the red line and into the playoffs ahead of the LA Galaxy. That was kind of hilarious. That was absolutely hilarious because Galaxy fans have been talking so much all year long on Twitter and every other social media. And to see them fall apart so completely down the stretch, and RSL, honestly, they did everything in their power to lose this spot with that 4-3 loss to the Quakes last weekend. I wrote them off. I had my tiers of the, you know, playoffs ranked thing, and I had a Galaxy blurb in there already because RSL had done so much to hamstring themselves. And to get in like that and to have the goal come off the foot of Krylak, who is one of the great players in RSL history and one of the underrated players in the league today, It was wild, and it was spectacular, and it's everything that decision day you hope it can be, and it was in that moment. And the other one is Wando's goal in retirement, which I am still trying to process emotionally, because for anyone who loves American soccer, you have to love Chris Wondolowski. What he represents as a player and what he's represented as a story, and hopefully what he can represent so all the other overlooked players who will be coming down the pike in years and decades to come. And, you know, I'm brokenhearted he retired. I honestly think he could have been a 800 minute a year, super effective, super sub until he was my age. But I guess Father Time finally won against Wando. So those are my two big takeaways from Sunday.
I don't think I'm a really emotional guy on a regular basis, but man, I got a little emotional watching that clip that was floating around on Twitter of Wando saying goodbye to San Jose fans. He chose to have his retirement speech not in the press conference after, or not in some sort of video posted from home on Twitter that then would be posted on Twitter. But no, he chose to have it on the field in San Jose at that stadium. It just felt so right and also so wrong at the same time, imagining an MLS landscape without Chris Wondolowski. That was a phenomenal moment. And to have him score in that game as well, it was the perfect way to go out in a lot of senses.
It was. Well, in a lot of senses. I think he would have liked to go out with a win. And I would have liked to have seen him, you know, go out in the playoffs. So like that's part of why I'm bummed that he's retiring, because, you know, all right, come back one more year, get into the playoffs and make one more good run. Give us one more super memorable Chris Wondolowski moment. But I admire the fact that he went out on his terms. And I'm going to be honest with you, Joe. I haven't watched the retirement speech yet. I don't know if I'm in the emotional space to watch that. I'll probably take a peek at it sometime in December after MLS Cup is done. But, you know, certainly the goal was a classic Chris Wondolowski moment. And it's nice. Let me just contextualize. I watch almost everything and have watched almost everything for the past 25 years from the context of wanting to see American and Canadian players develop and savvy and tactical awareness and know-how. And what is nice about it is that there are suddenly so many other young American and Canadian players scoring those savvy Chris Wondolowski type goals. So it felt appropriate in a lot of ways, and it felt like the baton has been passed to players like, you know, Brian White and Miguel Berry, and hopefully Io Akinola when he comes back next year. It's been passed, and it'll be in good hands or at good feet in the years to come. And so that was kind of nice as well.
We'll get to more of the decision day action in just a minute. I want to ask one more Wando question, Wando-centric question. What do you think is next for Wando Doyle? Or if not a prediction, what do you think he'd be good at? I'm just having a hard time wrapping my head around him doing something other than playing soccer. It's a similar situation with Kyle Beckerman, right? And now he has moved into coaching at the collegiate level. Could something like that be in the cards for Chris Wondolowski?
Yeah, I mean, I could see that. I could see him, you know, maybe wanting to just be a community ambassador. But what really intrigues me is the concept of skill coaches and positional coaches, like you have in the NFL and now to a lesser extent in the NBA, where it's like, okay, you know, this guy just like he's the wide receivers coach. He works with receivers on running routes and hip fakes and body position and everything like that. And it feels to me like soccer is behind a lot of the other big sports, certainly in America, in terms of having a coaching staff with such specificity. And I would love to see a world in which someone like Chris Wondolowski gets hired either by the Federation or by his hometown team to be like, look, I'm here to teach forwards how to make double moves off the ball. I'm here to teach forwards how to understand not just their own, you know, body shape, but the body shape and the hip positioning of the defender to know when to dart in front of them or when to fade back, you know, back post off their back shoulder. I'm, you know, my job is not tactics or strategy. My job is route running and repetition. So what intrigues me most is a world where Wando retires and that becomes his job, whether it's working with the academy kids or the first team or all of them. That's what I would like to see. And I kind of suspect that sort of thing is coming. I don't know if it's going to be with Wando or maybe a generation later. But I think it's a missed opportunity that doesn't exist for most or even any MLS team that I could think of. And I hope it's something that an ambitious team sees and thinks about and decides to take the initiative and really create that kind of, you know, built out coaching staff like we see in American football. I think that's something that, you know, soccer around the world can kind of learn from.
I love that, Doyle. I think that's a great idea. Let's get on that. Maybe Ernie and Brian can make some calls from Soccer House and we'll see what happens.
You don't think Anthony Hudson's teaching the boys stuff like that? No?
Oh, Doyle, I don't know. I don't think so, though. Who knows? I could be mistaken. We've got plenty more Decision Day chat to get to, but first, a word from today's sponsors.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Today's episode is brought to you by Shopify. On the Total Soccer Show, we often talk about the importance of a manager who can clearly and effectively communicate their tactics and then a squad of players capable of executing that approach, but also adding some individual flair along the way. And that's the same relationship you're getting with Shopify. You tell them how you want things to work or what you need to get done, and they execute the game plan, sometimes even better than you could have expected, with Shopify Magic, their AI-powered all-star. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage to the first real store stage, all the way to the did we just hit over a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. From what I've heard from family members who use Shopify for their online store, which has evolved into an amazing brick and mortar location, Shopify has helped with that growth. And with every step along the way, they've made it easier to process and track orders, run the business day to day, and help with long-term growth as well. So whether you're auctioning autographed jerseys or selling custom stadium prints, both of which are awesome, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% compared to other leading commerce platforms. And you can sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, the aforementioned AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States and is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, their extensive help resources are there to support your success every step of the way, because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial at shopify.com/TSS. That's all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/TSS now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. One more time, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/TSS.
Total Soccer Show, we are back with more from Decision Day, and we're going to do some looking ahead to the postseason as well. Doyle, I want to take our attention to maybe my favorite game, if not my favorite, one of my favorite games from Sunday, the Colorado Rapids 5-2 win over Bob Bradley's LAFC. That win put them first in the Western Conference and left LAFC outside of the playoff field. The Rapids played well in this game, and you don't always have to play well to score five goals, but oftentimes that does tend to happen. They created chances. The style that we're seeing from Robin Fraser, I think, is impressive and versatile in a way that a lot of other teams have been unable to match in Major League Soccer this year. But most importantly, man, the fact that this team, with what they spend, won the Western Conference. I should say what they don't spend, won the Western Conference. It's incredible. How do they do it, though? How did this happen?
You call them flexible and, you know, malleable and tactically amorphous at time, but then also tactically rigid when they need to be. And I think that is the key for Colorado. They have in Robin Fraser, I think, one of the best head coaches in the league, just in terms of creating a tactical blueprint that is executable for his team, and that speaks to the strength of the team, which is that there are no weak links. There, you know, I don't think the Rapids have any true stars. There's not, you know, who would come closest? Like maybe Mark Anthony Kay,
maybe,
you know, or maybe if Austin Trussie took a big step forward this year, if he takes another big step forward next year, I could see him being a best 11 caliber, but that's an if. And also, he might not even be in MLS next year. I think his contract is up and you know, there's European interest, but like, that's it. There are no stars on this team, but there are no weak links. And soccer is like, you need your stars to come through, but more than that, to be a good team, you need to have your weakest link be very, very strong. And Robin Fraser was able to go, you know, down to 22, 23 on the roster and no weak links. Even after they sold Sam Vines, they were able to, you know, to answer that need on the left side of the defense or midfield because they spent so much time in a 3-4-2-1. And so they don't beat themselves. They don't make it easy for you to beat them. And that was the key and on top of that, anything you throw at them tactically, they were basically able to match. It was almost like, you know, I wrote about this today. Like it reminded me of certain Serie A clubs in the late 90s where like none of them had a specific I don't want to say none, but most didn't have a specific formation. Most were totally willing to throw their defensive midfielder on at left back and their left back at right back and their right back at left wing if that's what the tactical battle of the day called for. And Robin Fraser has kind of done something like that this year. And it's credit to him for you know, being a good enough, I couldn't do that, for being a good enough coach to do that. But also credit to his players for being smart and flexible enough to do that. I mean, just being a super smart team is a very good advantage to have going into any game. And the Rapids were absolutely able to weaponize that all year long.
You hit on Robin Fraser a couple of different times in that response, which I appreciate. I want to dig a little deeper on Robin Fraser. I remember being pretty darn impressed with the work he did with the Rapids when he first moved from Toronto FC under Greg Vanney to then taking charge of the Rapids for just the last, what, six, seven games of that regular season a couple years back. He had instilled things in that team that we just hadn't seen in far too long from Colorado. And I think that's hugely impressive. I was filling out my end of year awards ballot on, shoot, what was that, Saturday night, Friday night? It doesn't matter. I was going through that awards ballot and Coach of the Year came up. And it's a hard one to pick, especially this year. We might touch more on that later. Ultimately, I voted for Bruce Arena, and I don't have any real regrets about that, but it was a hard decision. This accomplishment from Robin Fraser almost made me wish that I had waited and held off on voting just a couple days longer, because this is an incredible achievement, and it's been in front of our eyes all year long. It still would have been an impressive achievement had they finished third in the West. They were having a strong season either way, but the way the chips fell and the way the Rapids forced the chips into falling was impressive on decision day. Is Robin Fraser not a favorite for Coach of the Year, but he certainly deserves consideration for that award, right? I'm not crazy on that one.
No, I had him runner up.
Yeah.
I think this Rapids team is a 53-54 point team, and they ended up with 61. And that's a good amount of overperformance. And it comes from what Fraser did, both tactically and in terms of getting locker room buy-in, than any sort of talent advantage. What Bruce did, I mean, this team set the points record. And I know they have a really, really good team, but there are other really good or really talented teams that aren't really good teams. And the Revs checked both of those boxes, and they did it with a certain amount of style. And they were able to keep doing it even when Carlos Heal was gone, even when Matt Turner was on international duty. Like, look at their points per game. They didn't drop off. So I think Robin Fraser deserves all the credit in the world, but to push back against the way you framed it, this actually was an easy choice this year. If your team sets the single season points record, in spite of the fact that you've had injuries and international absences to your two best players, you deserve Coach of the Year.
Yeah, that's entirely fair. I want to look at the other side of this game before we move on to a game in the Eastern Conference from Sunday, LAFC. There have been some conflicting reports around Bob Bradley and a potential move to Toronto FC. Paul and Sam have been talking about that in more of a hypothetical way, if I've listened to their shows correctly, on Allocation Disorder, which drops typically on Fridays in the TSS feed. There's been discussion around Bob Bradley after what has been a really disappointing year for him and LAFC. In this game, particular against Colorado, I thought they looked rushed with the ball. I thought they looked disorganized. I thought they looked pretty much incapable of playing through midfield and instead just opted to play long balls from the back three into the forward line, or at least that was certainly an issue in the early stages of this game. What's gone wrong for LAFC, or maybe what are a couple of things that have gone wrong? Because in my view, there's maybe a semi-long list here, Doyle.
Yeah, I mean, they've made a lot of bad trades. They've had a lot of bad injuries, and too few of the young players that they've signed have developed. It started after that 2019 season when they got rid of Walker Zimmerman. That's going to go down as one of the worst trades in MLS history. He's a best 11 center back in his prime. Just give him a 5-year, do what Nashville did. Give him a 5-year deal and pay him seven figures and say, okay, we're not going to have to worry about this until 2026. Signing Brian Rodriguez, Brian Rodriguez is an immense talent. Signing him as your third DP when you already had Vela and Rossi, and you clearly needed a DP center forward, that was an unnecessary heat check. If imagine if LAFC, if that 2019 LAFC team had gone out and signed a Raul Ruiz Diaz style center forward, or even signed Christian Arango, who was so good this year. So they didn't do that. They just got so wild with the idea of bringing in so many young prospects that it's like they forgot about building a team. And then that was compounded this year by two big things. One being the injuries to Vela, Segura, and Atuesta. And that's your most important attacker, your most important defender, and your most important midfielder. That's one. And then the other is that they didn't finish well. Like, if you look at their, like, I'm talking about LAFC, and we kind of framed it as like, oh, this awful team, what happened to them? But also, like, if you watch any of their games this year, anyone would be like, this team plays beautiful soccer. This team knows exactly what they're doing. They get the ball into good spots. They create great chances, but they didn't finish them. Nobody finished anything until Arango got there. And that, like that, on top of the injuries, on top of the underperformance from the young kids, and then we'll add in the goalkeeper woes because, oh my God, their goalkeepers are not good. they hamstrung themselves. Like, if this team had Walker Zimmerman and Tyler Miller and you know, a DP center forward instead of having three DP wingers, they have 60 points. We're talking about them, you know, maybe breaking the curse and winning MLS Cup this year. But they got too cute, I think, in their roster build. There's a little too much YOLO in it, and they paid the price.
Oh, too much YOLO can be a dangerous thing. I think we learned that in LA this year. One thing I'll add to what you're saying, Doyle, statistically, and you mentioned some of the overperformance, underperformance, I should say. I was on American Soccer Analysis' site earlier today looking at some things for this show, and no team has underperformed their expected numbers as much, their expected goal difference to be specific, as much as LAFC has this season. So to your point about them playing some good soccer at times, I would argue it's been less clean and less picturesque than the height of their powers and when LAFC were at the height of their powers. But there's still things happening on the field with logical reasoning behind them. They just haven't turned into enough goals this season. And ultimately, that's a big part of what's left them out of the playoff picture. Flipping over to the Eastern Conference, a game that caught my eye in the early slot on Sunday was Orlando's 2-0 win over Montreal. Orlando locking up the sixth spot in the East. I mentioned this earlier today on the Weekend Review show. I'm a sucker for Montreal. I'm a sucker for what Wilfred Nancy's done, and I think the work that he's accomplished there this season has been nothing short of impressive. Orlando, though, for their part, they've done enough to make it inside the top seven in the East this year. But I can't shake the feeling that this team is not what they were even in MLS's back, which is really when I thought they started to burst onto the scene under Oscar Pereja. It feels to me like, and I think this is borne out in the numbers as well, they're not as dangerous with the ball. They're somewhat effective defensively, and they have good players. But it feels to me like the pieces aren't fully there right now with Orlando.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that at all. And it's to the point now where it feels like the MLS's back tournament, like that performance that Orlando put in over that month was the mirage. And the truth of it is that this team is just, they're not going to be the type that can beat you with the ball. They're not the type that can control where on the field the game is played and the tempo it's played at by dominating possession, because it's been a year and a half since then and they haven't done it. You know, the second half of last year, after the MLS's back tournament, they had two big injuries, João Moutinho, their left back, and Uri Russell, the central midfielder. When those two guys were so central to everything they did in possession that Pereja just ended up throwing up his hands and becoming a counterattacking team down the stretch, which was the right call. But they never fully got out of that mode at any point in 2021. Now, I kind of thought they would. I thought in September when, you know, Jackson Mendes came back and Moutinho was back, you know, Nani and Pereira were healthy, and you know, Daryl Dike is still a very linear player, but he's got more guile to his game than I think people realize. I thought that they would have a chance to sort of meld and become the type of team that their talent says they should be, but they're not. They're a good team, you know, and they're a talented team, but they only beat you in moments. They don't beat you over the course of the game. And maybe that'll be good enough, right? Because they do have some match winners, especially if Nani can, you know, find the Fountain of Youth one last time. But that is, I think, less than I had hoped for from this Orlando City side. And so it's kind of disappointing because, I think back to MLS's back, and God, they were so much fun to watch.
So good.
Yeah, and they're not that anymore.
Flipping us back over to the Western Conference, maybe the game of decision day, the 3-3 draw between the LA Galaxy and Minnesota United got Minnesota the 5 seed in the West, and thanks to RSL's win at the death that we mentioned earlier, the Galaxy left below the playoff line. I just thought this game was awesome. Both teams created chances in their own ways. Both teams looked vulnerable at times. It was fun, and it was a reminder of how the talent level in MLS is improving, albeit slowly. It is certainly improving with the talent that was on the field.
Talent level on the Galaxy backline is improving pretty slowly.
Well, that's a solid transition into asking a question about the Galaxy. They dropped off a cliff towards the end of this season. A lot of their underlying numbers were still okay, but, I mean, results-wise, it was night and day from where they had been earlier in the year, where they looked like a surefire playoff team. And you kind of addressed this earlier. It even felt like that was going to happen yesterday, on Sunday, as we're recording on Monday. This year under Greg Vanney, obviously his first in LA, kind of the new era post-Guillermo Barrichello, finishing outside the playoffs, certainly not a good thing. Tactically, though, I think there's a lot to like about what's been going on. Doyle, I'll ask you a simple question. Is 2021, has this been a successful season for the LA Galaxy?
No. It was a step forward, and I am much more convinced that they will have success in the future than I was a year ago. But no, this is the LA Galaxy. I don't think they get a moral victory here for choking at home on decision day. And for being one of the worst teams in the league since, you know, the end of summer or even longer back than that. I don't think a single person in that locker room would consider it a successful season. And I think the good news for the Galaxy is that, you know, Chicharito was so great all year. Well, when he was healthy, and not just great in terms of scoring goals, but great in terms of his attitude and his ability to sort of lift the guys around him and get them to play with more. It's cliche to say play with more joy, but like there was a difference when he was out there versus when someone else was out there. They looked up for it in a different way. Now, obviously, it didn't turn into wins as often as it should have, but when your best paid player has that sort of emotional effect on the team, that's good. But, you know, that defense is still a mess. I think Nick DePue is their best center back, and, you know, he's a converted forward from college, and, you know, they spent a ton of money on center backs again. I left this season still having no idea what their best formation is. They played a 4-4-2 yesterday, and Joe, did you see the amount of space between the center backs and the central midfield?
Gaps, like, baby.
Yeah, what the hell is happening there? and then there's Kevin Cabral. They spent $6 million for Kevin Cabral. They could have bought his team for $3 million, you know? There are some issues that are clearly based around talent identification that they have to solve, because it looks like even though they took a step forward, they got a lot of the personnel stuff wrong. And that is a worry going forward. As many positive things as there are, and there are positives for the Galaxy, there are a ton of worries about the fact that they still can't seem to sign a lot of the right guys.
A team that I do think signed and ended up signing a couple of the right guys is the Galaxy's opponent from this game on Sunday, Minnesota United. It feels to me like they might, emphasis on might, I'm sitting on the fence here as I so often do, have the right recipe to make a postseason run, right? So many things can change. There are so many factors there. But for me, though, a lot of that rests on some of the players that I'm referencing. Emmanuel Reynoso, who is not new to Minnesota, but is phenomenal. And then Franco Fragapane and Adrian Hunu, the left winger and striker, respectively, that Minnesota United brought in mid-season. How do you think those three guys have played together this year? And do you think they can carry this team in the postseason?
Yeah, I don't think they can carry him to MLS Cup. Last year, Bebelo Reynoso was like that. That was an all-time MLS Cup or MLS playoff performance from him. I think he had six assists in three games, a goal and six assists in three games. And he'll be good this year. He was really good on Sunday, but you can't expect your best player to be that good. And then the other guys are all good, but then you think back to last year and like Kevin Molina was maybe the second best player in the playoffs. And like, all right, Franco Fragapane is a good player. He's probably not going to be as good as Molina was. But it's still a really well-balanced and dangerous attacking quartet. Ozzy Alonso being healthy and playing the way he did in the second half of the year, having Ozzy and, a pretty serviceable Will Trapp, like that all works. But Minnesota, at the same time, they give up really soft goals. They don't have any foot speed up the spine, so they can just get shredded in transition. And then as good as the attack can look, they left a lot of goals on the table. I know they scored three on decision day and they scored two a week ago against Sporting KC, but like those are kind of outliers compared to what they've been doing all season long. So while I think they could put in a couple of good performances, Reynoso would have to go full supernova in order for this team to make MLS Cup. And he almost got him there last year with, as I said, one of the great postseason performances I've ever seen, but it may be lightning will strike twice, but it's tough to bet on it.
Listeners, we've got plenty more MLS chat to get to, but first, another word from today's sponsors.
Today's episode is brought to you by our old friends, Mack Weldon. Wouldn't it be nice if we could have things both ways, like a zero-calorie cheeseburger, internet ads in March that weren't just reminders to do your taxes, a dog that never needs walking after midnight when it's cold, a Manchester United that is consistently good instead of their current scattershot approach? Well, we tend to think of clothing as an either-or situation as well. People think looking sharp means starchy Oxfords and stiff chinos rather than effortless comfort. But it's possible to have it both ways. Mack Weldon makes timeless apparel with modern performance fabrics for guys who want to look and feel sharp without sacrificing comfort. From their light-as-air underwear to innovative anti-odor tees and versatile yet comfortable pants, Mack Weldon has a full range of clothes that never go out of style. I got a few things recently, including a long-sleeve polo, which I love, maybe the most comfortable t-shirt, which I also love, and my new favorite sweatpants, the Ace sweatpant. It's exactly what I described above, comfort and versatile, but still stylish. It's the type of sweatpant I can wear to pick up my kids from daycare and not think, I'm now wearing sweatpants in public. The other parents will judge me. Now I just think, judge away, nerds, because you will never be this comfortable unless you're also wearing a pair, in which case, high five. Mack Weldon is not flashy. It's just classic, always in style, and made from the world's most comfortable performance materials. They're designed to fit both your style and the demands of modern life. So get timeless looks with modern comfort from Mack Weldon. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your first order with promo code TSS. That's MackWeldon.com, promo code TSS to get 20% off your first order. Thank you to Mack Weldon for sponsoring today's episode.
Total Soccer Show, we are back once again. Thank you for sticking with us. Matt, I want to ask about the New York Red Bulls, not just because they've been lighting people up, myself included, on social media. They're in my mentions, and I welcome it. I bring it on, New York Red Bulls social media admin. But they're in phenomenal form right now. Gerhard Struber's team, after struggling for large parts of the season, has won 7 of their last 12 games, tied 4, and lost just one game. One of the most recent results, and the most recent result, was the draw with Nashville on Sunday on decision day that helped them snag the 7th seed in the Eastern Conference. I've been impressed, really, when I've watched the Red Bulls recently. They don't have the most talented squad, but they play Gerhard Struber's way, which is to say the Red Bull way, quite well. What's behind the turnaround for this team? How did they manage to turn this whole darn thing around?
Yeah, I think the formation change was a big one. You know, Struber spent the first half, or maybe even a little more than, I guess, 2/3 of the year playing out of either a 4-4-2 diamond or sometimes a 3-5-2. And that's the way he has gone about it in the past. That is the way that most Red Bull teams play, you know, in Salzburg and Leipzig and down in Brazil as well. Like, it's almost always a 4-4-2. It is sometimes a 3-5-2. And then for whatever reason, I think it was the fact that there's not really good balance between the forwards on the team. But anyway, he switched first to a 4-2-3-1 and then to a 3-4-2-1. I think it ended up making it more difficult for opposing teams to sort of cut out that or cut through the first line of the press. I think because of playing a more horizontal, a wider formation, they were able to just generate more field coverage. And I don't think teams quite figured out how to play through that. So if you look at the last, you know, 8-10 games, however long it's been, Red Bulls have been playing great. As you said, they've lost only once. They've also been controlling those games. Like, whether it's NYCFC or Nashville or, you know, DC to a lesser extent, though DC is actually a team that beat them, every one of those games ended up being played on the Red Bulls' terms. Every single team they faced eventually threw away their own game plan and said, we can't beat this press. We're just going to have to beat the Red Bulls at their own game. And DC was the only one who could do it. And that's partially because maximum overdrive, which is what we're calling Hernan Losada ball, is a close cousin of energy drink soccer. So DC were very well prepared to do it. Now, to be fair, I think Nashville could have easily had a game winner down the stretch yesterday. And, you know, Carlos Coronel had a couple of nice stops, and then Hani Mukhtar pushed one wide. But still, like, these are the margins that you have to be able to function in if you're going to beat the Red Bulls right now. So the formation change helped a lot. And the other thing is Struber changed a lot of personnel in like late summer. He just kind of, all right, threw his hands up and brought in 6 new starters. And this is in the midst of again, the summertime, during a year with a very condensed schedule because we had the late start. And everybody's legs were tired, except the Red Bulls, because they had 6 new starters. You know? So when suddenly you're playing this breakneck smash-bang press and you have a lot of fresh legs in there, you know, the press can be a lot more effective. And I think that was part of it. So it was weirdly good personnel management by Struber, who had not done well with that, I don't think, at all through the first half of the season. And to that end, I actually should mention Drew Yearwood as well, because one of the other things that worked was going to a double pivot in front of the back line. Whether they play 3 at the back or 4 at the back, it's always now Drew Yearwood and Sean Davis together. And I think that gave them, again, more coverage and more flexibility, but also, look, if you're pressing with a 2, then you're kind of aiming to send the opposing team down one of the sidelines, you know, down your strong side sideline. If you're pressing with a 1, you know, 4-2-3-1 or 3-4-2-1, you're going to have more of those moments where the turnover you're causing is going to happen in central midfield. And so putting another central midfielder in there, a guy who's a pretty decent ball winner in Drew Yearwood, to both protect the back line and to win more of those 50-50s or even just straight up loose balls, ended up working out very, very well for this team.
Doyle, you just walked us through the Red Bulls turnaround in a really informative way, so thank you for that. And we've also talked very briefly about Losada and Wilfried Nancy. At least their names have come up today. We talked about Greg Vanney as well. You had a tweet out towards the end of last week that was talking about some of these new coaches, or maybe more accurately, was talking about how many of them there have been. The tweet read, like this. Of the 26 MLS clubs that took the field 12 months ago, 13 have new coaches today. That could jump to 15 if LAFC and San Jose make changes after the season ends. It looks like that's coming in LA, and it might be coming in San Jose as well. So that may be a little prophetic from you there. Of the clubs with new coaches this season, who's impressed you most? I have a couple soft spots for a few different folks, but I'd be curious to hear your take on this.
I think you mentioned Wilfred Nancy before. And look, we all know that Montreal is one of the harder jobs in the league for a number of different reasons. And, you know, Thierry Henry handled that last year by saying, okay, I'm going to put the veterans out there. I'm going to play a 5-4-1 with at least three defensive midfielders on the field. And I'm just going to be tough to break down and tough to beat. And I don't blame Henry for that, because it was a COVID year. It was weird. And you do what it takes to get into the postseason, and they did. Nancy went in the other direction. He decided that while he kept a lot of the shape, though, it was much more of a 3-4-2-1 because both wingbacks played a lot higher, and then the half-space guys were real half-space guys and not just destroyers. They also got more and more comfortable with the ball as the year went along. They were able to play real soccer in a way that Montreal have not played real soccer often over their decade in MLS. And it's a shame they didn't make the playoffs, because it would have been good to see them there. But the thing with that roster is, I mean, they were at a talent deficit almost every single game, and that only grew. That deficit only grew down the home stretch during the most important part of the year. First, Mason Toy went out, and then Romel Kyoto and Victor Wanyama missed basically everything from the beginning of October onwards, and it was just too big a hill to climb. But I hope that Wilfred Nancy can be for Montreal what Jim Curtin has been for Philadelphia, because Montreal needs somebody like that, and they need to have patience with Nancy the way that the Philly ownership has had patience with Jim Curtin.
Yeah, I love that, Doyle, and I love what Wilfred Nancy has done there. I'm not so sure that having Victor Wanyama is more of an asset than not having him on the field, but yes, I certainly take your point there. Let's close out this show by looking at the playoffs. Quick format explainer from me. 7 teams make it from each conference. That's what this whole decision day thing is all about. The top seed in each conference ends up with a bye. So the Rapids have a bye in the West, and the Revs have a bye in the East. The bottom 6 teams then play in round 1, which is what we're going to focus on right now. That round will take place on Saturday, November 20th, Sunday, November 21st, and Tuesday, November 23rd. And then the one seed joins in, and we have ourselves some nice conference semifinals. For you, Doyle, are there one or two round one matchups that you're most looking forward to? Portland, Minnesota, Kansas City, Vancouver, Seattle, RSL out West, and then in the East, NYCFC and Atlanta, Nashville, Orlando, and the Red Bulls in Philly.
I mean, Nashville, Atlanta should be spicy, right?
It should be. Orlando, you mean.
Sorry, yeah. Nashville, Orlando should be spicy, given what happened last weekend. So I have my eye on that, but Philly, Red Bulls, that's a big one, because the Red Bulls, as we just talked about, they're cooking right now. But Philly play a similar style, so they should not be overawed in the same way that DC weren't overawed. Again, DC was the only team that beat New York over the past 2 months was DC United. In the same way DC weren't overawed, Philly shouldn't be overawed. And then there's more to it with Philly, right? Because every single year under Jim Curtin, this team took a step forward in the regular season. Like, if you go back to the start of Jim Curtin, like, that every single year they've had more points, and that culminated with last year winning the Supporters' Shield. What they haven't really done is taken a massive postseason step forward. They got their first home game a couple years ago against the Red Bulls, and they won it. That was their first playoff win. They had another home game last year in the playoffs, and the Revs smoked them. So if they're going to take a step forward this year, now granted, you could argue it already came in the CCL, but still, if they're going to take a step forward this year, it seems like it would be in the playoffs, and it seems like laying down a marker and you know, beating up on the Red Bulls would be a good way to show that Philly is not just a scrappy little team, but we need to start conceptualizing them, thinking of them as favorites in the same way that we've thought about Seattle as favorites for the past 5 years. So that is, in the Eastern Conference, I think those two stand out a little bit more than NYCFC Atlanta, which frankly should be NYCFC just smoking Atlanta. Atlanta's got one win against the playoff team all year long. NYCFC, by the underlying numbers, they're one of the two best teams in the league, and they're at Yankee Stadium in this one, which is a massive home field advantage for them.
Yeah, I'm all aboard the Philly Red Bulls matchup there. One other thing I wanted to mention in terms of playoff matchups is Vancouver SKC. I think my Scottish friend, who's also a host of TSS, Graham Ruthven, would be disappointed if I didn't at least mention Ryan Gauld's name on this show. So there you go, Graham. I've done it. He's been phenomenal in MLS this season since coming over from Portugal. He's been really, really good. But even more spicy than Ryan Gauld is interim Whitecaps coach Vanni Sartini, who is just a gem in front of the camera for the Vancouver Whitecaps. He said after the 1-1 draw that the Whitecaps had with the Sounders on Sunday, he was informed by a staff member on his team that they'd be taking on SKC, and just quickly and almost nonchalantly said, "We will beat Sporting Kansas City." So I'm excited for that one, if only to get more Vanni Sartini content. Before I let you go, Doyle, and I will let you go, I'm curious, can you give me one Matt Doyle contender and one Matt Doyle pretender, trademark patent pending, from each conference to really tie a nice, neat little bow on this semi-playoff preview?
Yeah, I think contenders, again, NYCFC are the fourth seed, so I think that sort of undersells how good this team is when they click. When they play good soccer, I'm not sure anybody in MLS plays better than they can play. And, you know, we'll... I think that they are heavy favorites in that Atlanta game. But then if they get past the five stripes, they go to Foxborough. That's a really big test. But we saw them go to Foxborough this year and handle the Revs. Like, they knocked the Revs around in Foxborough. So that, I mean, they are, NYCFC are, as far as I'm concerned, high-level contenders. I'm going to go Sporting Kansas City as pretenders.
Spicy!
Yeah, I know, it's a little bit spicy, but, Alan Pulido hasn't been healthy, hasn't played in forever. They have other injuries that they have to worry about. And then, I two things. So, with the way their press works, right, they press out of a three. And they're very good at it. To be clear, they are super, super good at it. Still, after 10 years of this from Peter Vermees, they're very, very good at it. But if you're able to break the first line of that pressure, then you get into midfield and it's a straight shot into the half spaces because they play with a single pivot, whether it's Ilya Sanchez or Remy Valta or whoever, they play with it. And so there's always space to one side or the other of the D-mid. And that puts a lot of pressure on the center backs to step up and to make plays. And they do it a lot. Like, their center backs have been very... I voted Andrew Fontas as Defender of the Year this year because he's that integral. But there's a difference between scrambling in the regular season and scrambling in the playoffs. And we saw that last year. This team gave up 6 goals in 2 games in the playoffs. And I just think... I think you could blow Sporting Kansas City up physically and with quick ball movement. And I think that we've been starting to see that a little bit down the stretch here. And so I'm not sure that I'm going to predict that Vancouver will beat Sporting Kansas City, but it wouldn't shock me at all. And I honestly cannot see this Sporting team hoisting MLS Cup. I think they're pretenders.
Ooh, baby, I cannot wait for this playoff action, not just to see if you're right or not, Doyle, but just because I'm generally excited about Major
League
Soccer.
I got some questions for you, though, Joe.
Please, yeah.
Two questions for you. First of all, how tall are you?
I am 5'10" tall.
Okay. All right, I had 6'2 in my head. I don't know, I just thought 6'2". All right, the second one, what is your 40 time?
Oh, gosh. I don't know. I never ran it back when that was all the rage in our Twitter group chat, to peel back the curtain a little bit. I imagine I am somewhere right above 5 seconds. Is that good? I want to be clear.
Fast.
Like, okay, slower. Joe, slower than that then. Slower.
That's fast. Okay.
5-5?
Total, Total Soccer Show listeners, you have to bully Joe into posting a video of him running the 40. He has to tweet a video of himself running. I think you should bully Taylor into it as well, and the whole cast of characters that you guys have on the show. Joe, we need to see this. By the time the playoffs are over, if we don't have a video of you running the 40, and I'm fine with a hand timed,
sure,
right? It doesn't have to be official.
That's
and
very generous. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm fine with hand timed. I'm going to be very upset, and I know the listeners of the show are going to be very upset as well.
Oh, Doyle, what have you done to me? I will no longer be attending the gym or lifting weights. I am strictly about speed training now. I need to get my time up before December 11th, which is MLS Cup. Doyle, you have just changed my workout regimen, and to be honest, I'm kind of here for it. The content is going to be real. Seriously, thank you, Doyle, again, for coming on the show. Listeners, you can follow Doyle on Twitter. You should. He's a must follow. And maybe more importantly, read his stuff at MLSsoccer.com. I look forward to that Monday column, Sunday night column, I should say. Maybe it's Monday morning for you when you actually post it, when it gets posted. But man, that's one of my go-to pieces every single week, as is everything else that you write. Once again, thank you, Matt Doyle, for coming on.
Thanks, Joe.
Listeners, thank you all so much for listening, and the Total Soccer Show will be back again soon.